the fatal shooting of a Palestinian journalist by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin sparks widespread condemnations. Russia says it is closely watching the configuration of the Western military alliance, NATO, on Russian borders. Also ahead, a U.S. warship sailing through the sensitive Taiwan Strait draws a stern warning from the Chinese military. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Israeli forces kill a reporter working for the Qatar-based Al Jazeera TV network in the occupied West Bank. Shireen Abu Akleh was fatally shot while covering an Israeli army raid on the city of Jenin. She was a veteran Palestinian reporter for Al Jazeera's Arab language channel. Israeli officials say the Palestinians may be responsible for the death of the 51-year-old journalist. But another reporter accompanying Abu Akleh, who was shot in the back, calls the Israeli claim an outright lie.
The occupation is murderous and criminal. They shot us for no reason. We, a group of journalists, were there wearing our full press uniform in addition to the helmets with the word press written in large letters, as big as the whole world. We were obvious. We made sure to walk right in front of the army patrols so that they can see us, and they saw us after we went to a road where there were no armed people, no civilians, and there were no shooting and no incidents there. We were shocked by the shooting. I was lucky and I turned my back when the first bullet was shot and injured my back. They wanted to kill me. I was injured in my back and the second bullet shot my colleague Shireen and caused her death. There were no armed people and we cannot put our lives in danger and say the wrong narrative. The Israeli army is a liar and criminal and despicable.
Samudi, who was shot in the back by Israeli troops, is now in stable condition. In the meantime, the Palestinian Health Ministry says a Palestinian teenager was also fatally shot in a separate Israeli attack in the West Bank city of Al-Bira. Condemnations are pouring in over the killing of Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh has slammed the killing. He says it shows the extent the Israeli regime can go to prevent the media from reporting the oppression of Palestinians. He has called on the world to investigate the issue and make sure that the regime is held accountable for its crime. A senior Qatari official called the killing state-sponsored Israeli terrorism, urging an end to unconditional support for Israel. An EU official demanded a swift and independent investigation to bring the perpetrators to justice.
We immediately called for a swift and independent investigation so that the perpetrators of this terrible crime can be brought to justice.
In the meantime, the Palestinian Authority says the murder is part of Israel's policy of targeting journalists to obscure the truth. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says Abu Akleh's killing lays bare the terroristic and violent nature of the occupying regime. Several media organizations and rights groups also condemned the killing and have called for investigations. Palestinians in the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, as well as people in several countries, including Tunisia, have taken to the streets to slam the killing. The Islamic Republic of Iran Broadcasting's World Service has condemned the Israeli killing of Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. In a statement, IRIB's World Service hailed the journalist's bravery and described her killing as a crime which will be etched permanently on human memory. The statement also expressed support for all reporters across the globe who have not remained indifferent to atrocities and unacceptable behavior of the occupying regime in Palestine. It said such journalists will forever remain alive in the heart and memory of IRIB staff. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps says it has destroyed the positions of terrorist groups operating in Iraq's semi-autonomous Kurdistan region. The IRGC's ground forces reportedly targeted the terrorist hideouts in the city of Erbil with artillery fire. There is no report of casualties and damage from the attack yet. The operation followed the arrest of a terrorist team planning to carry out sabotage attacks in western Iran. The statement says confessions made by detainees led to the operation on Wednesday morning. Iran has time and again warned Iraq's Kurdistan region that it reserves the right to hit terrorist groups operating in the region. In September of last year, Iranian missiles destroyed four bases of hostile groups, and in March of this year, the IRGC fired a dozen ballistic missiles at what it described as a secret base of the Israeli spy agency, Mossad, in our bill. Iran's intelligence ministry reports the arrest of two European nationals who had entered the country with the aim of destabilizing and unleashing social chaos. The ministry says the detainees are experienced agents without specifying their nationalities. It says intelligence units were aware of their intention and had been monitoring their activities and meetings since their arrival to the country. According to the statement, the two detainees wanted to turn the people towards social unrest, making their demands from the government a pretext. The ministry underlined that they were, in particular, seeking to take advantage of Iranian teachers' demands. Russia says it is closely monitoring the configuration of the Western military alliance, NATO, on its borders. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov was reacting to a visit by the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson to Sweden and to Finland. The two Scandinavian neighbors of Russia are currently debating about their NATO membership. The Swedish parliament is set to meet on Monday to debate the matter further. Later this month, Stockholm and Helsinki are expected to announce their decisions on joining the alliance. The two have for decades maintained military non-alignment. Last month, Russia warned it would deploy nuclear weapons and missiles in the Baltic region if Sweden and Finland decide to join NATO. Russia is strongly opposed to the alliance's eastward expansion and views it as a security threat. Senior Russian officials say that Washington is waging a proxy war against Moscow after the U.S. House of Representatives approved billions of dollars in additional aid for Ukraine. The deputy chairman of the Russian Security Council has warned that the aid package would only cause the U.S. economy to suffer. Dmitry Medvedev says Americans are already paying the price through inflation over its Russophobic stance. Separately, Russia's parliament speaker accused Washington of using the aid to indebt Ukraine. On Tuesday, the U.S. House approved a bill to provide $40 billion in financial and military aid for Ukraine. Moscow has repeatedly warned that American and European money and weapons to Kyiv would worsen the situation further. We talked to former U.S. Army psychological warfare officer Scott Bennett to get more on Washington's latest decision to provide Ukraine with extra financial and military aid.
I truly think they are beyond any rational, sane behavior. I think they are so pathologically delusional and wanting to believe their own lies that they engage in this silly lend-lease and exorbitant $40 billion sale of weapons that will only be destroyed the moment they hit the ground of Ukraine or are loaded onto a ship or transported. The Russians will annihilate every single weapon.
Russia's foreign minister says that his country has enough buyers for its energy outside of the Western world. This is the European Union intends to finalize a full embargo on Russian oil as soon as this week.
We have enough buyers of our energy resources and will work with them. Let the West pay much more than it paid the Russian Federation and let it explain to its population why it should become poorer.
Lavrov made the remarks during a news conference in the Omani capital, Muscat. He also stressed that Moscow does not want a war in Europe. The EU is hoping to stop buying Russian crude within 6 months and refined products by the end of the year. The bloc, however, has not yet gained full support of member states. The Hungarian prime minister has compared EU's plans to an atomic bomb. Bulgaria has also threatened to veto the ban unless it gets derogation. Other countries like Slovakia and the Czech Republic are also demanding special dispensations to accommodate their domestic needs. Ukraine's ambassador to the bloc, however, says EU countries should be ready for, quote, economic sacrifices to stop Russia. China accuses Washington of yet another provocation as a U.S. warship sails through the sensitive Taiwan Strait. A statement by the Chinese military calls the U.S. action deliberate, adding that it harms peace and stability in the strategic waterway. The U.S. Navy claims, however, that its warship only conducted a routine transit in accordance with international law. This is the second such incident in 2 weeks. China considers the island as its territory and views U.S. military activities there as a sign of support for Taiwan. Washington has no diplomatic relations with Taiwan, but it is the island's key backer and main arms supplier. Political analyst Einar Tangen from Beijing says the U.S. is provoking China because it is afraid of losing its superiority.
Currently, it seems that the U.S. has it's one-trick pony. It's continually trying to press issues. There's this desire for regime change, not only in China, but also obviously in Iran, Venezuela, you name it, and Russia itself. So this kind of ongoing pressure campaign, provocations, trying to get something to happen, and then trying to use proxies as a means of having any kind of conflict, not a direct conflict, but a proxy conflict. And this has been pretty much the game plan for the last few years. Biden does not seem to have any kind of master strategy that goes beyond it. The danger is that there is no clear exit strategy or end game. The U.S. Is poking all opponents in all places, basically because it doesn't believe that anybody should have a regime that is not similar to the U.S. one, and quite frankly, inferior. They don't want anybody to challenge them.
The new South Korean president has made an offer to the North which he believes may diffuse tensions on the Korean Peninsula, economic incentives in return for denuclearization. This approach, however, is nothing new and has not materialized in the past. So why would he think that this would work with a North Korean leader who has repeatedly called nuclear weapons part of his country's deterrence?
Yoon Suk-yeol has been sworn in as South Korea's new president. Yoon is a former prosecutor and won the election in March by the slimmest of margins. During his inaugural ceremony, he called for the complete denuclearization of North Korea, saying Pyongyang's weapons program poses a threat to global security. He said Seoul is ready to provide an audacious economic plan if the North commits to nuclear disarmament. If North Korea genuinely embarks on a process to complete denuclearization, we are prepared to work with the international community to present an audacious plan that will vastly strengthen North Korea's economy and improve the lives of its people.
While North Korea's nuclear weapons program are a threat not only to our region, security and that of the North Asia region, the door to dialogue will remain open so that we can peacefully resolve this threat.
And to think that is it possible to dismantle this deterrent program just with the promise that in the speech was made, the promise to commit a very strong economic plan if North Korea commit with his disarmament, I think it is a little bit unrealistic, this kind of request.
The new president has suggested a tougher line on North Korea, warning of a preemptive strike in the event of an attack and vowing to strengthen his country's deterring capability. He has favored stronger ties with the U.S. and adopted a rigid stance toward North Korea. Experts believe Seoul's policy toward Pyongyang will take a turn from rapprochement to more tensions. Yoon has not provided any details as to whether he plans to re-engage or provide economic incentives to the North. But officials in his national security team have said his government would devise a roadmap in the early days in which Pyongyang could quickly earn sanctions relief or economic aid in exchange for denuclearization measures.
Labour Party leader Sir Keir Starmer has pledged to step down if he is fined for potentially breaching COVID lockdown rules. Starmer and several members of his senior team are being investigated by Durham police after reports emerged that he had enjoyed a curry and drinks whilst assisting with a by-election campaign in the area. Labour officials have denied any breaches, but must await the results of an investigation.
To tackle the immediate crisis, to bring
opposition leader Sir Keir Starmer has been at the front of the chorus, urging Prime Minister Boris Johnson to do the decent thing and step down, after being fined for his part in a series of lockdown gatherings dubbed Partygate. Now the Labour leader has become embroiled in a controversy of his own, nicknamed Currygate, after being pictured enjoying a meal and a drink in what the party's calling a work event, but one being dubbed an illegal gathering by his opponents.
First and foremost, no rules were broken. I don't actually believe that those that are accusing me believe rules were broken. They are trying to simply drag all politicians into a place where the public think we're all the same. For me, this is an in-principle position. No rules are broken. I'm absolutely clear about that. But in the event that I'm wrong about that and I get a fixed penalty notice, I will do the right thing and step down.
Political observers think this is a risky strategy.
Well, I think that his advisers think this is a really good ploy to contrast him with Boris Johnson, who, of course, didn't resign, having been fined for breaking the lockdown regulations. But it's a dangerous ploy as well, because he's not in control of what the police investigation is going to find. And if he does get fined, he's now been committed to resigning as leadership of the Labour Party.
The Labour Party had desperately wanted to take the moral high ground when it came to their handling of COVID rules and regulations. Not just in the House of Commons, but in the court of public opinion. But now with their leader caught in the spotlight because of his own missteps, supporters of Boris Johnson are hoping to capitalise on this political mistake and make Labour pay.
Whether or not the leader of the Labour Party is fined, for many of the electorate, this is yet another letdown. Politicians who seemingly are unwilling or unable to play by the rules. The police investigation could take as long as a month to conclude. Now Labour and its leader must play the waiting game and cross their political fingers that this high-stake gamble has paid off. Mina Taylor, London.
The Russian president has called on officials to do more to tackle deadly forest fires raging in Siberia. In a virtual meeting with regional officials, Vladimir Putin warned that there should be no repeat of last year's fires, which were the biggest on record for the country. He said the blazes threatened both the people and the economy. The fires that erupted last week have claimed 8 lives so far and destroyed hundreds of buildings. High winds have hampered efforts to put out the blazes. Scientists believe soaring temperatures in Siberia as a result of climate change is the main reason for widespread blazes. Some 4,000 wildfires were reported in Russia this year alone.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable Discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
If the U.S. were genuinely interested in some sort of political solution to the Israeli apartheid practices regarding the Palestinians, nothing would be easier than to just step aside and let the world punish Bennett for his brutal policies, which amount to war crimes. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Juan Cole, journalist. This article is published under the heading U.S. Double Standard on Display in Tepid Response to Israeli Regime's Theft of Palestinian Land. Stay tuned for more. The The deputy spokesperson for the U.S. State Department, Yelena Porter, recently condemned the Zionist regime's announcement that it would build 4,000 further housing units in the Palestinian West Bank. That is, it would steal land owned by Palestinian families and bring in squatters from the Zionist regime to squat on that land. The full lack of seriousness in the U.S. regime on this issue is obvious. The Zionist regime maintains that the Palestinian West Bank belongs to it, even though no such baseless claim is recognized in international law. The Israeli newspaper Arab 48 reports that the Israeli civil administration of the occupied Palestinian West Bank will decide on 3,988 new housing units for Zionist squatters on Palestinian land next month. This additional building of housing infrastructure on Palestinian land will ultimately further displace and impoverish Palestinians, the rightful inhabitants of the land, Palestine. The fake regime of Israel can behave this way, in brazen violation of the international law governing how occupying powers treat the people they occupy during wartime, only because the U.S. regime runs interference for Israeli regime in international bodies. Otherwise, the world would put sanctions on the fabricated regime of Israel for invading and occupying and trying to annex Palestinian land. Separately, we understand that the Zionist regime announced a meeting to advance new West Bank settlements for West Bank settlement units for May 12th. The Biden administration has been clear from the outset. We strongly oppose the expansion of settlements, which exacerbates tensions and undermines trust between parties. The Zionist regime program of expanding settlements deeply damages the prospect for a two-state solution. So then, Ron Campis, the Washington, D.C. bureau chief of the Jewish Telegraphic Agency, asked what the repercussions will be for the Zionist regime in going ahead with the new housing settlements. He wanted to know how it would affect President Biden's planned trip to the occupied territories in June. Hint, there are no repercussions. Ms. Porter replied, as one might expect with platitudes so excruciatingly mind-numbing that no one else would want to raise the question again for at least a century. I will just say from here that we have been clear about the need to avoid unilateral steps that would exacerbate tensions and make it more difficult to preserve the viability of a two-state solution. I have nothing to comment about the president's upcoming trip, unquote. There is no viable two-state solution. The fabricated regime of Israel has plunked down so many hundreds of thousands of squatters in Palestinian population centers that the territory looks like Swiss cheese on a map. It is just something American politicians say to kick the can down the road while the Israelis grab more and more of the West Bank. It is sort of like telling a team of bank robbers in the midst of a heist that you really regret their unfortunate actions and urge them not to damage the liquidity of the bank beyond the point where both the robbers and the bank owners can coexist. If the U.S. were genuinely interested in some sort of political solution to the Israeli apartheid practices regarding the Palestinians, nothing would be easier than to just step aside and let the world punish Bennett for the brutal policies, which amount to war crimes, Washington wouldn't even have to be proactive itself. The Zionist regime prime minister, Naftali Bennett, made $200 million with software and would feel the pain if he were sanctioned. But official Washington is so in the tank for Israeli apartheid that making such a suggestion sounds outlandish.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladheena amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we will listen to the speech of Sheikh Osama Abdul Ghani.
So dear brothers and sisters in Islam, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. So welcome to our last talk about the transition. So alhamdulillah, Allah has given us the tawfiq to be discussing the akhirah and readying ourselves for that eventual journey that we're going to make. So what we were talking about was the Akhirah, the Barzakh. And why it is, actually we're talking about the mercy of the Barzakh. Why it is that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala would have the Barzakh for us. What are the benefits in the Barzakh for the mu'mineen? I mentioned some of them the other day. One of them I just want to remind us about was the idea of that sadaqah which is jariyah, continuous sadaqah. If you and I can do something that continues after us, for instance, let's say we're involved in Islamic media work that continues after us, a building which is people who are going to be worshiping Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, that's another one, right? A book, maybe we can be involved in writing a book, training students. We talked about the idea that human resources, human beings are more valuable than anything. That was the true miracle of the Anbiya. So maybe we could try and do all of them to cover our bases. This is also another beautiful, there's a verse of the Quran where Allah says this in the Quran. Surah Baqarah 274. Allah says this, أَلَّذِينَ يُنْفِقُونَ أَمْوَالَهُمْ, those who spend their wealth, بِاللَّيْلِ وَالنَّهَارِ, at night and during the day. Sirran wa alaniya, secretly and openly. They say this verse was revealed about Imam Ali. He covered his bases. He had four dirhams. The Imam gave one of them in the day, one of them at night, one of them secretly, one of them openly. The idea of covering our bases. So you and I, if there's anything we could be doing to have a sadaqah jariyah so that we're still have that, we're reaping those residual effects of our iman, even once we've left this world, then we definitely want to do that. Another thing that's mentioned in the ahadith about the barakah and the mercy of the barzakh is that for some of the believers who haven't done enough, because tawbah fixes everything, but let's say someone hadn't done enough, sometimes the grave and that time in the grave acts as a kafara, because Allah doesn't want the believer to go to hell. Al-maut kafaratun lidhunubil mu'mineen. Death acts as a kafara for the sins of the believers. Of course, the idea would be to make tawbah and not have to face them. But there's something else that I found that's interesting, mentioned by some of the ulama. What they say is this, that time that we spend in the barzakh prepares us to experience Allah's best in the hereafter. And this way, that the blessings in the hereafter are too intense for us in this human form to be able to bear. Both the torments for those who are militant about disobeying Allah. We have in the hadith that once Angel Jibreel was mentioning, because you know we have verses in the Quran about those chains that the inhabitants of hell will be chained with. Angel Jibrail told the prophet this. He says that if one of those, one link of that chain was to come here into this world, لَذَابَتِ الدُّنْيَا مِنْ حَرِّهَا, the dull dunya would melt from the heat of one link of that chain. So both the torments are too intense, but also the blessings, they're very, very intense. What some of the scholars say is this, that going through this period in the barzakh, where we're able to experience some of the joys, and we're able to get ready for those joys that Allah has for us, that's another one of the blessings of the barzakh. I'll give you some examples. Once Angel Jibrail asked Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for permission to discover how vast paradise is. How vast is paradise? And Allah gave him permission. Angel Jibrail started flying, and he flew for 30,000 years till finally he got exhausted. And then he asked Allah, he said, I'm exhausted, I need more strength. And Allah gave him double his original strength. Again, the angel flew for 30,000 years. And again, the same thing happened. Again, Allah gave him strength. Finally, the angel asked, he wanted to know, have I made it? Is it the end? And one of the Hurul'een said that, Angel Jibril, don't tire yourself. This is a waste of time. All this time that you've been flying, you haven't crossed the property of one of the mu'mineen. It's mentioned in a hadith that if the clothing of the inhabitants of paradise were to be put here in this world, the clothing, لَوْ أَنَّ ثَوْبًا مِنْ ثِيَابِ أَهْلِ الْجَنَّةِ, just the clothing from the children, from the people of paradise, if that was to be brought here in the dunya, the people would faint from looking at it. And then, of course, no matter what we've heard, that's nothing compared to what Allah really has over there. Allah says in that one hadith Qudsi, "Adadtu li'ibadi, I have prepared for my servants ma la 'aynun ra'at wa la udhunun sami'at wa la khatara biqalbi bashar." The things that I have ready for you on the hereafter, those blessings that I have for my righteous servants, he says, are things that no eye has seen, no ear has heard, and has never crossed human imagination. So the thing is, brothers and sisters, it's like Imam Ali says, the time now, the Imam says this, the rest of your life is priceless. Let's take advantage of now. Nabi Isa, his mother passed, and Nabi Isa buried his mother. And when he saw his mother in the barzakh, and she had the state that she had, it's mentioned, what a wonderful state. I mean, remember, she's the best of the women at her time. Her state in the barzakh, he asked her, he said, is there any desires that you have left? I mean, you had a son like Isa, you were the best of the women of the world, Allah gave you the virgin birth. She said, yes, I wish, even though she had been on the other side, I wish I could come back to this world and to fast on those long summer days, those hot days, and to stay awake at night on cold winter nights, because she knew the value of what she was doing. The thing is, you and I, we're not going to get a second chance at life. The idea is to use it right now, to try our best to benefit. How rare is it that somebody, and again, this lets you know, I mean, the story that I want to share with you, lets you know the station of the Ahlul Bayt, but how rare is it that somebody can get a second chance? For you and I, we have to take advantage of now. And by the way, nobody should doubt that the Ahlul Bayt, alayhim as-salam, can give life, that they can bring people back to life, because Isa in the Quran, he was able to bring the dead back to life. Sayyid Fatima Niyaw was saying that once he went to Austria, and when he gave a speech in Austria, one of our Sunni brothers was participating or came after, and he said that, why is it that you say that the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam are higher than the Anbiya? He said, actually, you say the same thing. It's mentioned in reliable books, reliable ahadith. This is the one that I'm going to mention, that he mentioned, that our prophet said, Atani malakun, an angel came to me, فقال يا محمد, the angel said, O Muhammad, سل من أرسلنا قبلك من رسلنا على ما بعثوا. Ask those messengers who've come before you, what was the condition for them to be sent? What was the condition? And the prophet asked, the response was, عَلَى وِلَايَتِكَ وَوِلَايَةِ عَلِي ibn Abi Talib. The wilaya of Rasulullah and the wilaya of the... Otherwise, they don't even get a chance to be prophets. So our imams are higher than them, and this is mentioned in other books.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Azim Alimun Halim Hakimun Mateen.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. English Radio.
In the limelight.
In the United States, the white net being cast by Justice Department prosecutors as they move beyond charging 6th of January rioters could encompass scores of potential witnesses from both inside and outside of government. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Alan Feuer, Luke Broadwater, and Maggie Haberman. The piece is titled Justice Department Investigation of 6th of January Confronts Sprawling Cast of Characters. Among the challenges facing the federal grand jury recently empaneled to investigate the 6th of January attack on the Capitol is the sheer number of people who might have information relevant to its inquiry. According to a subpoena issued by the grand jury, prosecutors are asking for records about people who organized or spoke at several pro-Trump rallies after the election. They presumably include two events in Washington in November and December of 2020, that preceded the gathering on the Ellipse near the White House on 6th of January 2021, where President Donald J. Trump told the crowd to descend on the Capitol. The subpoena is also seeking records about anyone who provided security at those events and about those who were deemed to be VIP attendees. Moreover, it requests information about any members of the executive and legislative branches of the government who may have taken part in planning or executing the rallies, or tried to obstruct, influence, impede, or delay the certification of the presidential election. Each of these broad categories could involve dozens of individuals. Taken together, the total number of potential witnesses, or at some point targets, sought after by the grand jury could easily reach into the hundreds. The investigation appears to be in its early stages, and there is no way of knowing at this point where it may go, what crimes it might identify, or who it may ultimately focus on. Many people of interest to investigators might be called only as witnesses. One possible roadmap, at least in terms of who the grand jury may still want to hear from, is the parallel probe by the House Select Committee investigating the Capitol attack, which has already interviewed hundreds of witnesses, including on Tuesday, 5th of April, Ivanka Trump, the former president's daughter and advisor. A relatively small group of political operatives did the bulk of the work in organizing the pro-Trump rallies in Washington that kicked off after the election and sought to challenge the results, often using the slogan, "Stop the Steal." Prominent among them, according to interviews and documents, was Amy Kramer, a former Tea Party activist who helped create a group called Women for America First. The group set up a cross-country bus tour gathering Mr. Trump's aggrieved supporters behind the baseless assertions of a stolen election. Within hours of the last polls closing on Election Day, Amy Kramer started working closely with her daughter, Kylie Jane Kramer, to set up one of the first Stop the Steal Facebook pages. Both women were involved, often in close coordination with the White House, in planning pro-Trump rallies on 14th of November and 12th of December 2020, and then in setting up Donald Trump's appearance at their lips on 6th of January 2021. To other people who helped Amy Kramer were Jennifer Lawrence and Dustin Stockton, both of whom had once worked closely with Steve Bannon, a former top advisor to Donald Trump. Another organizer for Women for America First was Cindy Shafian, who ultimately broke away from the group to form a new organization, the 80% Coalition, which planned its own event on 5th of January 2021. Then there was a separate group of planners around Ali Alexander, a provocateur who rose in right-wing circles after the election. Mr. Alexander, an associate of Donald Trump's longtime advisor, Roger Stone, was part of a group of activists who planned an event at the Capitol itself and marched with the crowd to the building after Donald Trump's speech at the Ellipse. Altogether, scores of people spoke at the rallies in November and December and at the gathering on 5th of January and 6th of January. They included people like Mr. Stone, Donald Trump's former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, and Alex Jones, the conspiracy theorist and host of the television show InfoWars. The speakers also included pastors, state-level politicians, and anti-vaccine activists. It is hard to know who prosecutors might consider a VIP from these events, especially for the November rally, often known as the Million MAGA March, and the one in December, which is sometimes referred to as the Jericho March. There were dozens of VIPs who attended Donald Trump's incendiary speech at their lips on 6th of January 2021, according to leaked documents from event organizers. That rally also featured appearances by Rudolph Giuliani, Donald Trump's personal lawyer, and John Eastman, the law professor who was promoting the idea that Vice President Mike Pence could block congressional certification of the Electoral College results. The attendees at the Ellipse speech included Mike Lindell, the MyPillow chief executive who helped spread Donald Trump's lies about a rigged election, and the YouTube stars known as Diamond and Silk, who are prominent Donald Trump supporters. The federal grand jury subpoena examined by the New York Times seeks information about members of the executive and legislative branches of the government who might have been involved in the effort to delay congressional certification of the election results, suggesting that prosecutors are interested in learning more about the roles that Donald Trump's aides and allies inside the government may have played. It is not clear if any Trump-era executive or legislative branch members have received subpoenas, and there is no public indication that anyone has been targeted for prosecution. But in looking for more information about what was happening at both the White House and on Capitol Hill as Donald Trump sought to stay in power, the House Select Committee has already expressed interest in a range of White House and campaign advisors, as well as contractors who worked to set up the rally. They exist in concentric circles in and around Donald Trump's orbit. Among them is Mark Meadows, the White House chief of staff under Donald Trump, who turned over text messages to the House Select Committee that served as a roadmap not just for his own activities, but those of others. He was one of the few people with Donald Trump as the riot at the Capitol took place. Katrina Pearson, a longtime Trump political advisor, was in direct contact with Donald Trump about the details of the rallies on 5th of January and 6th of January 2021, including who would be speaking and what music will be played, according to a former administration official and a House committee. Katrina Pearson attended a meeting in which Donald Trump is said to have discussed wanting the National Guard deployed, anticipating counter-protests. Caroline Wren, a professional fundraiser and a friend of Kimberly Guilfoyle, an advisor to Donald Trump and a girlfriend of Donald Trump Jr., was listed on an attachment for a permit that rally organizers gave the Park Police. Megan Powers, a longtime Donald Trump aide, was listed on a rally permit. Among the Republicans in Congress who worked publicly to keep Donald Trump in power were Representatives Mo Brooks of Alabama, Paul Gosar of Arizona, and Andy Biggs of Arizona, all of whom Ali Alexander, the Stop the Steal organizer, has said helped set the events of 6th of January in motion. We four schemed up of putting maximum pressure on Congress while they were voting, Ali Alexander said in a since-deleted video posted online, so that who we couldn't lobby, we could change the hearts and the minds of Republicans who were in that body hearing our loud roar from outside. Paul Gosar's chief of staff has said his office merely promoted Stop the Steal events and was not involved in planning them. Mr. Biggs, who provided a video message for Ali Alexander to play at a 19th of December rally, has denied coordinating event planning with Mr. Alexander. Mo Brooks, who wore body armor on stage on 6th of January 2021 as he told the crowd to start taking down names, also denied coordinating with Mr. Alexander. Mo Brooks recently turned on Donald Trump after the former president rescinded his endorsement in a Senate race and said Donald Trump had repeatedly asked him in recent months to illegally rescind the election, remove President Biden, and force a new special election. Mr. Brooks was one of two members of Congress who spoke at Donald Trump's rally at the Ellipse before the attack on the Capitol. The other was Representative Madison Cawthorn, Republican of North Carolina, who weeks earlier encouraged the public to call members of Congress and lightly threatened them if they did not support Donald Trump's claims of voter fraud. Representative Louis Gohmert, Republican of Texas, unsuccessfully sued Mike Pence over his refusal to interfere in the election certification. Other Republicans who used inflammatory rhetoric around that time included Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia and Lauren Boebert of Colorado, first-term lawmakers who referred to the day as Republicans' 1776 moment. On 21st of December 2020, Donald Trump met with members of the House Freedom Caucus to discuss their plans to challenge Joe Biden's victory. Among those present were Paul Gosar, Mr. Biggs, Mo Brooks, Marjorie Taylor Greene, and Representatives Jim Jordan of Ohio and Scott Perry of Pennsylvania, who were deeply involved in Mr. Trump's efforts to fight the election results. The House Committee has so far asked only three members of Congress for an interview: Representative Kevin McCarthy of California, the Republican leader who engaged in what he called a very heated call with Donald Trump during the riot; Jim Jordan; and Scott Perry. All three men have refused to agree to a voluntary interview.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies: 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of the speech delivered on April 12, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the government officials of the Islamic Republic. I could equally mention assembly companies and assemblers. Assembly is actually a kind of unnecessary importation in a different way. This is not production. This is not creating a product. Rather, it is merely a kind of importation. Such companies should not be allowed to register as a knowledge-based company. This is not correct. Therefore, there is a need for defining precise criteria and indicators for these companies. I think that this falls on the Vice Presidency for Science and Technology, and the other organization that is in charge of approving these companies. These must take these criteria seriously. Another point is that in order to assess whether the country's production has become knowledge-based or not, merely looking at the number of knowledge-based companies is not enough. In my New Year's speech, I stressed numbers. It was said that such and such a number of companies can be established this year, but I said that there should be more. They said that such companies might increase by 30%, but I said that it should be 50%, at least 50%, but it could be 100% too. Well, this is related to quantity, which is a criterion, but it is not enough.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The companies that are established must have certain characteristics which are vital and fundamental. One of these characteristics is that there must be innovation in them. Another is that they must help reduce foreign currency importation. At the present time, in order to import certain products, we spend hugely. If a knowledge-based company manufactures this product or brings it close to manufacture, this will either reduce the expenditures or it will completely eliminate them. This is one of the criteria. One of the criteria for knowledge-based companies is that they must create employment in the true sense of the word. They must have the capability to export. In other words, they must be competitive in the face of global products. These criteria must be specified and pursued, God willing.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.